Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy from Paradigm Sports. Thanks for joining us for our second digital summit hosted through our digital platform for Love of the Game. Got an amazing group of speakers like we had in the summer, and our next guest is Dr. Gordon Bloom. He's published many research articles and contributed chapters in several books in the area of sports psychology. He's also been a researcher and practitioner working with many coaches for the last 20 years. Is also a youth sports coach. Just come back from a hockey tournament and shared some great anecdotes on that front. Thanks for joining us, Gordon. I'm really looking forward to our chat.
Pleasure to be here, Glenn.
The first question I ask everybody, and I know that we've kind of, just so everybody knows, this is kind of a do-over because we had some technical issues, so we're going to try to spin it a little differently, but where did you grow up and what youth sports did you play when you were growing up?
I grew up in Toronto, and I was one of those athletes that, rather than specialize, I played a lot of different sports. So my three sports that I played competitively the most would be hockey, baseball, and tennis, and I still play all three. Maybe not so well, but I am a lifelong sports nut junkie. I love studying it, I love playing it, I love watching it and talking about it. So it's been a part of my entire life.
What was your fondest memory growing up in sport?
For me, certainly, I played on my high school baseball team in Toronto, and we were a really good team. And we got to the Toronto Championship, which, again, there's a lot of high schools in the Toronto area. And that was the first year they moved the high school championship to where the Blue Jays were playing. So in that case, it was Exhibition Stadium. And we got to play in the first Blue Jays Cup. And we played right before a Blue Jays game. So I think we started about 4:30 our game. And had like over 1,000 people there. Usually we'd have about 2 or 3. So that's pretty incredible experience for a high school athlete to be able to play at Exhibition Stadium, especially since I was a big Blue Jays fan.
Yeah, I was kind of reminiscent when I was playing football. We got to play in actually BC Place. And the irony about that, though, is going to from grass fields to turf, we didn't realize the importance of taping up our ankles. And early on in the game, there was probably 5 or 6 players that twisted their ankle just because they're not adjusting to it and we're wearing the wrong cleats. So they stopped the game and said, okay, you know, let's do this the right way. Get your cleats off, go into a proper cleats, let's tape the ankles. And that was a great experience too. I think that game was provincial championships. We probably had about 3,000 people in the stands, and like our normal games, maybe 25. So it was pretty surreal being able to play that level. So when did you get into coaching?
I mean, I always, even when I was like in university, I would organize our intramural team in university, and then I'd be playing softball or baseball in the summer with my buddies, and I was always one of the coaches, one of the organizers, so it sort of came naturally to me. And you know, I did think at one point maybe I would pursue a career in coaching. Thought about that, thought about sports journalism. But ultimately, I decided sports psychology was the path, and study coaching. And then, as I think is a natural progression with many parents, I have 3 children, and they all played organized sport. I have 2 sons and a daughter, and they played baseball, hockey, and soccer. And I've been coaching them for about 15 years. And if you hear my voice is a bit raspy, it is because we had a hockey tournament this weekend, and I coached 5 games in 3 days, so the voice is quite raspy right now.
Yeah, and tell us about the end of that, then the end that you just shared with me.
Well, I, you know, again, been coaching for 15 years, and this was the probably the most exciting experience I've ever had. I've had a lot. The way this hockey tournament works is we got to the championship game, and we were losing 5-2 going into the third period. And somehow we scored 4 goals to go up. We haven't done that all year. To go up 6-5, a minute and a half left. They tie it up with 20 seconds left. So we end up going to an overtime. And the way this tournament does it, and I've never been involved in this, but it's so much fun, is the first one is 4-on-4 for 2 minutes. And then a buzzer goes. If you don't score, then you go 3-on-3, 2-on-2, 1-on-1. So 4-on-4, nobody scored. 3-on-3, nobody scored. And then 2-on-2, one of our guys popped it in to get us the medal. So that was an exciting way to finish the tournament.
And what age group is that?
This will be midget boys.
Yeah, so 15, 16-ish age group. So yeah. Playing full ice, 2-on-2, you know, it's comfort zone. Thankfully, there weren't 8-year-olds trying to play full ice for that age group. But it's probably the most fun that most of my team, starting in Pee Wee, we used to do Russian hockey at the end of our practices where I'd blow a whistle. And it was funny watching the kids, how they tee up against each other, especially if they anticipated that 1-on-1 and you'd see them go back and shift the lines, stuff like that. It's quite funny. Yeah. A great way to finish a tournament.
Yeah.
So why sports psychology became your focus?
Again, I was always interested in how people think and behave in sports. And part of it, I was captain on a lot of teams. I used to like talking strategy to my coaches. My parents were saying I was always analyzing sports when I was watching it on TV. Read a lot of books as a kid just about how people think, act, behave. I mean, I read the book by Ken Dryden, The Game. And that really, there was a level of introspection in that book that just took me to another level of thinking. And sports psychology was really just starting out when I looked into graduate school, and really happy I made that choice. And now it's certainly in our department, we get more applications for our sports psychology graduate program than any of the others, which I just think it's a really hot topic and it's really growing and people are appreciating it. So I was fortunate I got in early and haven't regretted the decision since that time.
Yeah, I wish it was evolved to the point it is now when I was, because that was my career goal with sports psychology, but I went to UBC, did the phys ed degree, graduated. Well, the year I was about to graduate, I said, oh, how do I keep going? He said, well, you know, you're going to have to go do some a lot more psych courses and do your master's. And I could have been in school for like 10 years before anybody even graduated. So I said, you know, I'm going to go this way because it's just going to take too long. But I've always been passionate about the whole mind of sport. And it's amazing that it's evolved to the point it has. And that there's a lot of options available to people that want to get into that path instead of, you know, 20, 30 years ago where it wasn't really mainstream. So, you know, one of the great, well, there's actually a few nuggets that you shared, both with the Ontario Coaches Conference when I saw you speak, and right in behind you is one of those nuggets, the coach of all time, John Wooden. So share some of the nuggets that you've shared at that conference.
Yeah, on my wall, there's a couple of 8x10 photos signed by Coach and his pyramid of success. So, for me, when I started my PhD degree, we decided that with my supervisor at the University of Ottawa, he had access to some of our top Olympic team sport coaches. He said, you're going to study the knowledge and the thoughts and the behaviors of team sport coaches, our Olympic coaches. I said, great. I said, you know, the best way for me to get started in my PhD is to read what I thought would be the best coaching book. So I looked around, and one that kept popping out was They Call Me Coach by John Wooden. And I was aware of Wooden's accomplishments at UCLA. Not a big basketball fan growing up, but I know they had won a lot of championships in the 70s and were very successful. I started reading his book, and it was just resonating with me like, you know, just sort of boom. All of a sudden, you're reading this stuff and going, yeah, that's what I think. That's how you should coach. This is what a good coach should be. Somebody who really cares about their athletes first, who focuses on doing things well, on the process, and not so much about winning, although it's just an outcome if you do things the right way. So it really resonated with me. So you know, being the first year PhD student that I am, I decided to write Coach Wooden a letter. Don't know why I did that, Glenn, but back then we didn't have email. So, you know, write a letter to UCLA. He was retired, but figured I'll send it to their athletic program. And just basically telling him that I had read his book. It was very inspiring. And I was hoping that my line of research would somehow be connected to his way of coaching. It's basically all I wrote. And then, like, less than 2 months later, in the mail, I get a reply from Coach where he signed the Pyramid of Success and a couple of 8x10 photos to me. And I just was floored. I mean, here's someone who was voted the greatest coach in the last century, you know, taking the time to write back to this unknown Canadian scholar. And I didn't ask for anything. He just took the time to do it. So it really stuck with me. And then when I finished my PhD at University of Ottawa, I got hired at California State University, Fresno, otherwise known as Fresno State. And I knew one of the profs at UCLA, Tara Scanlon, in sports psych, and she knew how much I loved coaching and how much I was a fan of Coach Wooden, because I knew she knew him. So I talked to her a few times. And anyways, a couple of years, I'm down in California. She's inviting him in for a guest lecture to her sports psychology class. She asks me if I want to attend. I'm like, do I want to attend? How fast can I get there, right? So I took the trip to UCLA, and he must have been about 86, 87 at that time, and spoke to a class of about 300 students. Complete silence in the room. You could tell reverence for everything he was saying. And I'm sitting there going, this is wonderful. And then she invited me afterwards for, you know, a chance to meet with him upstairs with a few of the faculty members. And I got to go see him and got a picture taken with him, and didn't say too much because I was really in awe. That was my first experience. So then 2 years later, she's inviting Coach in again. And at that time, a friend of mine was doing his postdoctoral fellowship at UCLA with Tara, who I studied with, Wade Gilbert. And basically, he calls me a couple days before, and he says, you know, Tara wants to know if we can pick up Coach. You know, he's about 90 now. He doesn't drive anymore. If we could pick him up in his condo, drive him to the talk, and then drop him off after to his daughter's house. I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. Somebody is looking down on me just saying this is a lifetime opportunity. And so we did it. And Wade was very busy, focused on the driving, because he didn't want to get lost or get in an accident with a living legend in the car. And I was in the back seat talking to Coach for about an hour one-on-one, and remains the highlight of my professional career to this day.
Yeah, that'd be pretty amazing. Did he share any great poetry in that car ride?
Well, I got to tell you, poetry is amazing, because when he would speak to this class, he would recite poetry, maybe 3 to 4 minutes long by memory, these poems that he knew as a kid, like he was sharp as a thumbtack. When we were in the car, you know, it was kind of interesting. Wade and I reflected on this after. We felt like we were students in his schoolhouse, because, you know, he always referred to himself as a teacher.
Yeah.
Just the way he spoke to us, it's hard to put into words, but there was always like a message with what he was saying. He would just, and it would be subtle and so discreet and so respectful. But anytime we would get off target or we would say something maybe that he didn't agree with, he would gently let us know what he was thinking in a way that never made you feel bad. It was an incredible experience.
Yeah, that would just be like a wow moment, you know, being there with the greatest mentor of all time and LA traffic. You had plenty of time to do that. So that's a pretty amazing story. So from that experience and your research on coaching, what have you determined? You've already kind of touched on one of them. What do you think the top three characteristics would be of great coaches like John Wooden?
Well, one is that they're a teacher first. And I think if you're as a coach focused on being a teacher, Coach called himself a teacher. I think that's the first lesson. And I try and tell people that. I think the second thing is, you know, being a teacher and teaching life skills first. You know, win or lose, you want your athletes to take away life lessons from sport. So I think that's important. I think the third thing that I would say maybe is focus on the process. When you're a coach, parents and kids are so enamored with wins and losses. And, you know, coach always focused on the process. And not many people know this, and but he had a losing record for a number of years when he began coaching at UCLA. Everybody just knows that his career winning percentage was, I think, something over 80%. But he didn't have a winning season for, I can't remember the exact number of it, I'm thinking 5, 6, or 7, or 8 years when he began there. They didn't win. And it was just building a program, putting his pillars in place, his philosophy of success in place. So it takes time to do that. And if you take your time, put the process in place, you'll reap the rewards if you're doing it the right way, like Coach did.
Yeah, and the one accolade I hear a lot about when I talk to people that have had the opportunity to meet, he never actually used the word winning in a conversation. It was about the success. And when people would say to them, hey, you won all these championships and you coached Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton and all these other great players, he like humbly turned around and says, yeah, but I also coached some amazing people that have gone on and did some amazing things, maybe not in the NBA. Is that some of the anecdotes you heard?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you're very close to a story that I had, because I was at one point in the conversation talking to him about these great teams and asking him, you know, who was the greatest team you coached? And, you know, they won like 80 games in a row at one point. And who was the best player? And, you know, he didn't want to go there. And he said to me very clearly, I still remember it, you know, I'm proud of the success of my teams and my individual athletes, but to be perfectly frank with you, it's the people that were good citizens, that were good parents, that were good members of their community, regardless of what their profession was. It wasn't the person making the most money that was important to him or had the most fame. It was just a good citizen. And you know, when he said it to me, I kind of went, oh, geez, yep, coach is teaching me, because I went off track. And he brought me back. So, no, Glenn, that's very true. It's exactly the way he was.
Wow. And how old was he at the time?
88 to 90.
Wow. and
sharp. Like, there was no pause. There was no memory lapse. Just sharp as could be.
And he's the only, to the best of my knowledge, the only speaker that Ted ever let sit in a chair. And when I watched his TED talk, I was just like, you know, I've probably watched it 10 times. I was just like, wow. And how he just rattled off those poems and stories. And I'm like, and he was pretty close to, you know, I think he was in his 80s when he did that TED talk. Was, you could tell his mind was, do you think there'll ever be anyone like him? And I don't think there'll be another John Wooden, but will it ever be, you know, based on your research?
I don't know, because I hold him in such high reverence. And again, I've watched that TED talk, and the two talks he gave at UCLA that I sat in on were almost identical to those TED talks. The content, but just the fluidity and the way he was able to remember stuff and cite poetry and remember when he was growing up and interactions he had with his father. I don't know. I mean, his brain was just so sharp for so long. If we do get another Wooden, that would be, you know, tremendous. I always, you know, the person that I always held in high regard to him was the legendary American women's basketball coach, Pat Head Summitt. She was tremendous. She had tremendous success at Tennessee. I read a lot of her stuff, and I thought very enlightening the way she coached and how she coached, and had a lot of Wooden philosophies. And then, you know, unfortunately, she gets early on, you know, onset Alzheimer's, and then passed away from it. So, you know, to be able to be in your 90s and still be able to contribute to coaching, that'll be tough to find anyone else that will be able to match the, you know, his accomplishments and everything he's done for coaching.
Yeah, one of the other anecdotes that I share a lot in the clinics or wherever I'm at is how he was passionate, really passionate, like a Claire Drake, about lifelong learning. and would go to all these conferences. He'd be asked to do his talks, you know, 70s and 80s. And then he'd go sit with the rest of the coaches. And another person would come up and do a talk. And the infamous, he'd pull his notepad out and he'd start writing a whole bunch of notes. And people would be looking at him going, hey, wait a minute, Mr. Wooden, what are you doing? And he goes, shh, I may learn something. Like that just shows that why his brain, I think, kept going is because he never stopped learning. And that's the real importance that we're trying to encourage a lot of grassroots coaches. Don't just think because you took a clinic that you're done. That's, in my eyes, that's just the beginning of what hopefully could be a long journey.
Yeah, that's something that's come up really clearly in the research that we've done, is that the best coaches are lifelong learners. Two things that have really come up, Glenn. They're lifelong learners, and they like to reflect a lot. So I look at it as a bigger picture. They're never complacent. They never think they have all the answers. They're not afraid to ask questions. They're not afraid to share their knowledge with other people. You know, like I said, I've met Coach and always shared his knowledge. I've had some interactions with Claire Drake and Dave King, who are Canadian ice hockey coaches, through some affiliations I had when I was doing my PhD, and they were the same way, willing to share, open their practices, their mind, their knowledge to everybody else. And I think sometimes, and it happens even in youth sport, where people don't want to share their knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, because they're going to give away these secrets, these nuggets. But when you have some of the best coaches who are the exact opposite, they should be the role models, and they should be the ones, you know, that people should be aspiring to be. I mean, Phil Jackson, arguably the most successful professional coach, 11 rings, and he's got two books that he wrote that talk very clearly about how he coached the Chicago Bulls and the Los Angeles Lakers. He wanted to share his knowledge, his philosophy with people. He didn't keep it to himself.
Yeah, and 11 Rings is a great book with all those anecdotes. And one of the things I loved about that is when Dennis Rodman piped in and gave some insight about what it was like being coached by Phil, and saying that Phil was the only coach that ever taught, treated him like a man, which I thought was, you know, kind of brilliant, because Dennis Rodman was quite the character. But he turned into, like, on the Bulls team, he was one of those years, he was the best rebounder in the NBA.
Yeah.
Like, it was amazing how he transformed and took it, you know, his craziness, I guess, for lack of a better word, and transformed into the player that Phil aspired him to be.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think one of his greatest accomplishments would be what he did with Dennis Worm. That they called him the Worm, right? Dennis the Worm Rodman. And, you know, he was very different in how he behaved away from the court and did a few crazy things on the court. And most coaches thought he was uncoachable. He was selfish, uncoachable. Jackson managed to get him to become part of the team, probably with the help of Michael Jordan and Scottie Pittman. And I think really turned Rodman into a successful, one of the best rebounders, defensive players, and team players, you know, in the last 30, 40 years. And maybe you could say the same thing with Kobe Bryant when he took over, you know, coaching the Lakers. I think Kobe Bryant was very self-centered and was all about himself and was feuding with Shaquille O'Neal. And I think Phil Jackson, the way he coached him and made him one of the greatest players in NBA history, probably tells you everything you need to know about Phil Jackson. And you're right, it's in those two books. He talks about how he coached Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal, Dennis Rodman, Michael Jordan. You know, I think he said in his first book that he wrote that you know, when he took over the Bulls, they were Michael and the Jordanaires.
Yeah.
You know, he had to go to Michael and say, you want to continue being the best player in the world and scoring all 40, 50 points a game? Or do you want to be the best player in the world, score fewer points, but win NBA championships? And I think he said, because Michael said the latter, everything just flew from there.
Yeah, he figured out how to push his buttons as well as the rest of the players. And memory serves me right, Steve Kerr was one of his players under his tutelage. And look what he's doing now with Golden State Warriors. He's kind of following that whole Phil Jackson mantra. Yeah. Not too long ago, I remember Steve letting the players run plays during a game, and everybody went crazy. What are you doing? He's empowering his players, and they had a lot of fun doing it, and partly because it was a route. But the other side of the coin is, you know, there's some great things happening with some great coaches because of they had great coaches before them. So you touched on Pat Summitt earlier, and one of your students, you sent me an article, and I actually had an opportunity to read it, and you also shared the anecdote of the OCC about Chantal Vallée, who was one of your master students, who then did this study, went on to coach in Windsor. First couple of years kind of struggled, but then she took that team to 5 national championships and is one of the first women now to have been offered a coach and general manager position in the upcoming men's elite league in Canada. Tell me a little bit about Chantal and how she was able to accomplish that.
Yeah, it's a really incredible story. So it was interesting that I came to McGill in 2000 and, Chantel was accepted into our graduate program, be supervised by somebody else, began before I got here. And so they interviewed me, and then apparently she had, like, I was hired like November to start in July, and she had just started a couple months before. And she was meeting with someone who was going to be her supervisor. She said, you know, to her, I want to learn how to become a better basketball coach. She goes, I just read this article by this fellow in California who did a study on Jerry Tarkanian, who was a famous American basketball coach. Yeah. And we observed him. He was coaching at a university. So we did an observational study of his teaching practices during practices. And anyways, it inspired Chantel, and she's meeting with this supervisor and saying, I want to do some more work like this. And the supervisor goes, do you know that we just hired him a week ago? And she says, what? He's talking about California. She goes, no, he's a Canadian and he's coming to work in McGill. Chantal told me, she just like kind of went, well, what's going on? And the supervisor said, well, why don't you speak to him? Maybe he'll be your, you know, you two could somehow become an advisor. So we had a phone call, and I was just impressed. She says, you know, I'm an assistant coach on the women's basketball team here, and I aspire to be a head coach, and I want to do a study that will teach me to be a better coach. And I don't care how long it takes to do it. I want to become a better coach. And she goes, I read some of your stuff and it really resonated with me. And I was just like, this is a perfect first graduate student for me. Somebody who's read some of my stuff, who is a coach and wants to do a study on becoming a coach. And also, unlike some graduate students that put you on the clock, you know, 2 years and I want to be done. It's like, she's like, I'll wait for you to get here. I'll delay my graduation to 2.5 years so that we can work together. So, you know, the way we met, it just kind of one of those things is just happened by total luck. And so she arrived, and I knew somebody in the Coaching Association of Canada, and they were promoting women's sport at that time. And basically they had a grant for her to travel around the country and meet with the top women's team sport coaches, sort of about how they, you know, sort of ascended to the top of their profession. And one of the things that came out there was, you know, they all took over programs that weren't very good and created this vision and built programs that were successful on the court and off the court. So we published that article in a fairly good sports psychology journal in 2005. And Chantel graduated and got a job offer. Her first offer was at the University of Windsor. And I had written her a letter of reference, so I knew she was interviewing for it. She calls me up after, and she goes, I got good news and bad news. I said, what's that? She goes, the good news is I got hired to coach university. It's like, great. She goes, the bad news is at Windsor. She goes, you know how bad Windsor is, right? And I was like, well, since you interviewed there, I did some research, and they were pretty bad.
Yeah, I heard they were like right at the bottom.
Right at the bottom. They never hosted a home playoff game in their 50-year history. And like they'd fired 3 coaches, I think, or had 3 coaches in the last 3 years. So it was right at the bottom. And I said to her, well, looks like you're going to take what you learned from your thesis and have a chance to apply it. And she goes, yep. That's what I was thinking. She goes, I got to just figure out how to do it. So I knew she was equipped. And I knew she had everything that it would take to do great things with Windsor. And, you know, she would share some of them with me. How do you recruit at a place where nobody wants to go to? And anyways, first couple of years were tough. And then the third year started turning around things a bit. And by the fourth year, they were getting really good. The fifth year, they make it to the championship game and lose in the championship game. And we talk after the season. She goes, man, I didn't reach my goal. What are you talking about? She goes, well, I don't you remember I told you we were going to win a national championship in 5 years? She goes, I told you that when I took over the program. She goes, that's what I was telling everybody. Personally, I guess I'd forgotten because I probably didn't think that was ever happened. But she remembered, and she was upset that it didn't happen. And I was like, oh, boy. She's pretty on the ball and ready to go. And then, sure enough, the next 5 years, they won 5 national championships in a row. And, a landmark of success in university sports. And because of that success, we were asked by a sport coaching journal. Editor Wade Gilbert, who knew her story, said, hey, why don't you take what you learned from her thesis publication and what she's done in coaching and write an article how she turned around that program. And we published that in 2016, and that's probably what you were referring to. So now she just got hired, as you said. She's on sabbatical for the year. So to help her pass her time, I guess, she's been hired as the first women coach and general manager for a men's professional team. She'll be coaching in the, like you said, the Canadian Elite Basketball League, which goes from May till August. And then I believe go back to her job at Windsor at the end of August, early September. So she's continuing to break gender barriers, and she's still very young. And I think she's going to have a great career still ahead of her.
Yeah, I think she's going to have an amazing career. And the sabbatical that she's on, share with some of the people that she's interacting with to prep her for that Men's Elite League.
Yeah, I mean, she's from Quebec and from the Montreal area. So she came here first in September. So I've been having some meetings with her. And, she's always pressing me for information. You talk about lifelong learner. Every summer after her season was over, she'd always call me and say, you know, what should I read? Do you have any good books that are out there? And I remember a few years ago, a book came out called Legacy, which is about the New Zealand All Blacks. And it was one of the best coaching books I ever read. It talks about the culture. And like a lot of people, especially in North America, don't know that they're the most successful sports team, I think.
In history.
In history. Yeah. Like in the last 100 years, their winning percentage is over 75%.
Yeah.
And it's just a little country. I've been to New Zealand. It's a tiny little country. But the way they embrace and connect with their rugby team, the connection to the Maori culture and what it means to be a part of that team. I mean, one of their philosophies is, sweep the sheds. That means that they do not have attendants clean up their room. They pack their own bags. They put their own bags on the buses and the planes. They unpack it. I mean, it's an incredible what they do and their culture and what it stands for and how these people act. Anyway, so I told Chantel, I said, you should read this book. She read it. She loved it. Then last year we were talking. She's like, where am I going to go to learn? And, I said, well, what about New Zealand? I said, right. That's what I say. I'm like, okay. So I guess she took it to heart and she found somebody that she knew from Australia or New Zealand that had a connection with the All Blacks for basketball coaching. And anyways, she's got like a 3-week sabbatical where she's going to go down and I think in January, February, spend some time with the All Blacks, just observing what they're doing. So personally, I can't wait till she gets back to, pick her brain.
What did you learn?
Oh, I mean, it's going to be incredible. And in basketball, I think she's reached out with Dwayne Casey, who's an assistant or a head coach on the Detroit Pistons. And that's not far from Windsor. And he's invited her to spend some time with them observing his practices. And I think she's trying to get, see if she can also get Greg Popovich, something that she holds in high esteem as well. So, again, just taking advantage of her sabbatical, trying to learn and grow and get better. And that's how you become better.
Yeah. And a lot of that, Steve Hansen is cited at the All Blacks. It's not just about developing All Blacks, but it's developing great people. And that's the John Wooden of the world. And that's really what our role is as coaches, is not just developing athletes, but making them into great people and well-rounded and what have you. So I can't even imagine. My son had an opportunity to do a hockey exchange in New Zealand and share how long it took to get there and what it was like, the flights. But the people are amazing, and they're very, very passionate about the All Blacks. You know, if you look at the last two World Cups of rugby, which they won, the one before that, they struggled, and they've totally transformed. Another great thing that comes out of that book is better people make better All Blacks. So they recruit players of character first, skill second, instead of going for the most skilled, because sometimes those most skilled, they're a little bit more selfish and what have you. So, you know, 15 great nuggets in that book that if you read that book alone, it'll help you kind of transform your team. So hopefully, and I suspect she's going to have a really great career going forward, and she's pretty young. So yeah. Mentorship, that's something that I suspect, are you really proud of her because she was one of your students?
Yeah. And it's just great to see her go on and achieve their goals. You know, I've got a fair bit of students who come through my program in the years who coach sports teams. Just to see them reach their goals and their dreams and their aspirations is really incredible. And, I remember she was at the last Olympics and she was doing the commentating in French and English for the basketball, and I'd be watching her on TV and just really proud of her. And, you know, what she's doing a lot for women's sports as well. So, like I said, breaking barriers is pretty cool. And I said, her and I used to talk about Pat Summitt a lot when she was a graduate student here. She was really inspired by her story. And the other one was a football coach, Gary Barnett, who coached at Northwestern University. And he turned around a Moorabound football program. I think he took over the program, and there were some guys that played 5 years at the program and never won a Division I game. And he took them to the Rose Bowl in like 5 years. So those were some coaches that really inspired Chantel, and then to see her following their footsteps, it really is nice to see.
Yeah, and a lot of it is from looking at what they did to transform those programs and do the right things instead of just keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, which is insanity. A lot of programs that continuously go through coaches, like, you know, they use that as they point the fingers that those are the people that are not doing what they should be when they should, which is, you know, it's kind of unfortunate. They're the first ones that, like, it'll go, like what's recently happened in the NHL. How many coaches were let go midseason? Like, I'm a big Green Bay Packers fan, and they get let go of Mike McCarthy, and I'm just like, well, oh, but, and they, what do? They go and win a game after he's gone. I was like, I don't think it was coaching. I think there was a whole bunch of other stuff going on. So switching hats to coming down to the minor sports, you've been coaching your kids in a bunch of different teams, a bunch of sports. So what are some nuggets you can share with coaches so that the parent role as a coach sometimes can be muddy, and sometimes parents don't want to have parent coaches. So what have you done differently so that parents can relate or you can engage them on your teams?
One of the things that I always do is I've told my children when I coach them that I'm going to hold you to a higher level of accountability than everybody else on the team. So I'm conscious of not favoring my own child. I think that's important because parents will pick up on it easily, and you're better off to err on the side of caution. And even if your son or daughter is the best player, they don't have to play them the most. And that will send a message to everybody that you're fair and you're not there to get them an advantage. The other thing I try and do, and honestly, Glenna, even for me, it's not easy to do, is educate my parents about the value of youth sport. And I tell the parents, my number one goal this year is that every child that I coach wants to come back and play next year.
Yeah.
I tell the parents, it's not about winning. I tell them, I'm competitive. I'm going to win. But you got to have talent first to win. And every U sport coach who's won championships has had talent. It doesn't make you the best coach if you win. It's based a lot on talent. Coaching makes a difference.
Yep.
So I just tell parents, my credentials, so they don't argue with me face to face about that. But, other parents or my managers tell me, yeah, they're so mad that they're not winning. And they say their kids are having a good time and you're fair and respectful, but you're not winning enough and it really bothers them. You got to push harder or change things up or discipline. And so I get it. I mean, not to my face, but I know what you sport coaches are dealing with, and you just have to stick to, you know, what you believe is right and what you believe is fair. Because you know what I tell all the coaches 10 years from now, kids you coach, when you see them in the streets and you don't recognize them, they're not going to remember your win-loss records. They're not. They're going to remember how you treated them.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I run into that all the time. Seeing the kids I coach when they were 5, now 16, 17, 18, and they still call me coach, which is kind of neat. I've had a few show up on my doorstep now that they're at the age where they can drink and say, hey, coach, let's go for a beer. And the next wave is going to be being invited to weddings and graduations. And that's when it really, you realize the impact, the positive impact you had on these kids versus, and we never really talk about wins, losses or anything like that. And he said, hey, you know, all that kind of stuff. So pretty amazing anecdote in terms of how we can kind of engage the parents and get away from that winning all costs. And I'm going to ask you a question. I've talked to a few speakers. What was your take? And did you hear about the 41-0 novice game in Ontario that happened?
Yeah.
What's your spin on it?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, didn't the coach say, well, we shut it down because we made them pass more before they could shoot, right?
Yeah, basically, the articles that I read, there was a bunch of them that went out. And I just about fell out of my chair because my morning routine is I grab the paper, I read the sports section, and I'm looking at it and it says, you know, phone calls as a result of 41-0 blow. I'm like, whoa, wait. And then I look at the age group. They're 8. And so the biggest issue with that was the fact that they were 8 and they shouldn't be playing full ice hockey anymore. It really should have been mandated cross ice, but Hockey Canada had to take the baby steps. So they did the 5-6-year-olds first, and then they rolled out the 7-8-year-olds. Whereas some provinces like British Columbia, they just pulled the trigger and said all age groups. So that for one, full ice, for me, when I was coaching at that level, was crazy. I called it the beehive, where you had like 2 or 3 of the early bloomers, and they were skating around with a puck, and the rest of the kids were just chasing them. You know, so nobody's having fun. But when you got a 41-0 game that isn't on the scoreboard, they did a 6-0 score differential so that they wouldn't see it. But the kids know. They know what the score is. My take was, why didn't anybody talk about the goalies? Like that kid that was in the net that got peppered, he's probably never putting pads on again and possibly never going to play hockey again. The kid that was not peppered at the other, 200 feet away was just kind of bored to tears doing snow angels in the whole 9 yards. I don't know. And the big kerfuffle was that association, that league did not have a mercy rule. So they should have called the game, say it's 15-0, but going back to our days, I played a lot of outdoor hockey and pond hockey. That never would have happened because the kids would have rebalanced the teams if there was a blowout, right? Like we would have said, hey, Johnny, you come over here and you go over there. And so that we wouldn't have that happen. So I'm kind of like, was that an adult thing or was that, the parent thing? I don't know. It just frustrates me that ever happened to begin with.
I think it's terrible. And I don't like people rationalizing it. Why we did it or we did this or that. But you have to say it's wrong. We made a mistake. Here's the mistake we made, and here's how we're going to fix it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how a referee or the coaches after the first period or even the second period didn't talk and figure something out. Stop the game at, like you say, the very least. Mix up the goalies or mix up the teams. The game's over and we're just going to scrimmage or something, which I know some parents are going to complain and scream about. Yeah. That's right. But when you're a coach, that's part of your job is to help your team win with respect and dignity and lose with respect and dignity. And it cannot happen when the score is a football score. Terrible. Terrible.
Yeah, and then you have the excessive celebrations of the kids that are on 49, and then you have the portal, all that stuff kind of simulates through. So what can we do or what can coaches do so kids love the game more at the end of a season than they did at the beginning?
I think encourage kids, I don't try and tell kids they did something wrong. I mean, when they make a mistake, you point it out, but you tell them what they can do better to be better. And then when they do something that you've asked them to do and they do it right, make sure you catch them doing it right. You know, we just, it's always negative feedback. And the drive home, the parents will say, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. So as coaches, we're teachers. Again, teach them, motivate them, inspire them. And you can do that. Every communication you have with a kid sends a message. And if you want to reprimand and beat them down, they're going to feel that way at the end of the year. You build them up, inspire, motivate, challenge. They'll want to come back and play the next year.
Yeah, that to me is the big, should be the bar to determine whether he's a great coach or not. If all the kids come back the following season, if you only have half of them come back, that to me is a red flag. There's a reason why they're not coming back. So some rapid fire questions. You already talked about Legacy, which I think is one of the top five books of all time for coaches to read. Are there any other books that you recommend for coaches?
The ones we said, 11 Rings by Phil Jackson, a really good one. And obviously They Call Me Coach by John Wooden. Those are my three favorite books. So, I mean, I've got a lot of others, but those are my three favorites.
Yeah, I mean, the Legacy one for me was kind of, because I'm a big rugby, that was my favorite sport. I played them all, and then once I got into rugby, it was like, you know, now I've had an opportunity to coach it. I'll never forget my first rugby team about 3 years ago. They were a junior team, so they're grade 8, 9, and 10, so 13, 14, 15. And we didn't win any games because most of these kids had never played before and stuff like that. And they came to me about halfway through the season, Coach, we got to have a haka. I'm like, guys, you know, we're not quite there yet. I spent time explaining what the haka was all about. It wasn't about intimidation. It was all about the tradition, the Maori people, you know. And they were like, but we got to have the haka. And I said, tell you what. If we score a try next game, we'll come up with something, but it'll be our version, but it's not going to be. And it was just priceless. These 13, 14, 50, and they came up with some form of thing pre-game. I'm like, yeah, okay. But you got to respect the fact where that's coming from. What about from a parent perspective, any books or resources you recommend to parents?
Any books? No, there's nothing that's coming. Yeah, no, I haven't got any off the top of my head. I just read a lot of material, but as far as a book, no, I think a lot of parents, they don't like to read anyways. I think they can watch some of, like, you know, the stuff that your company is producing, these types of webcasts. If parents can watch the right ones, watch John Wooden's TED Talk, just learn about what sport really is. You know, just to educate parents about the value of life skills, personal growth, dealing with adversity. If parents can find anything to read or to watch that reinforces things the right way, that's a good thing. But there's nothing that comes off the top of my head.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And, you know, one of the things I share in my parent meetings is the importance of educating parents of the motivations why kids are actually playing sports. So some of the research out there, they play sports because they're fun, they quit when they're not. And my infamous quote, it's not rocket science. But the motivators, you know, if you think about kids, is they want to play, have an opportunity to try their best. This is Amanda Visick's great research that she just did. And very, very similar to when I was asking kids, is all the teams, is like, why are you playing? And they want coaches that treat them with respect. They want to have playing time, play well as a team, you know, get along with their teammates. There's no harassment. Those are the drivers. But sadly, and the U.S. model has really exploded in terms of it becoming a financial monster. Most recently is now been seeing it's over $17 billion. Yeah. When I first went into the space about 10 years ago, it was about $7 billion. So it's more than doubled. And it's the focus on wins and wins and wins. But if you ask a kid, you know, what's important to you, like winning doesn't really come up on their radar screen. It's all the other good stuff.
Yeah,
it's fun, and they enjoy the experience and the pool parties. But a joke that I share with everybody, okay, two things that kids will say after a game is, what's the snack and when do we play again? So then, you know, if you said you're still playing three different sports, so you're still playing adult recreation hockey, yep, a.k.a. beer league, what's the first question that you ask when you get in the dressing room?
Did you have fun? Did you exercise? Are you healthy?
No, but it's from your adult perspective. Like, you get in the dressing room, you're playing beer league. What do you ask?
What do I ask?
Yeah. Where's the beer?
Well, that's after the game.
Yeah, after the game, not before.
Oh, I said before the game. Sorry. Yeah,
well, kids, they say sorry. You didn't disconnect. Kids, the two things they ask after a game is what's a snack. So when they're younger, it's like the Timbits and stuff like that. Yeah. They leave the dressing room after when everybody's all dressed up. When do we play again? So you're coaching or you're playing adult recreation league. What's the first question you ask?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right? Definitely. Where's the beer? Yeah.
And how much is it? And what's the last question you ask?
When are we playing again next?
Yeah. So if we do our job right and kids love the game as much as they keep playing adult, like that hockey is one of those sports you can play. Like there's a guy in the Lower Mainland that has a sheet of ice he's had for, I don't know, 40 years or something at Eight Rinks in Burnaby. And he got into his 80s and Eight Rinks was threatening to pull it from him. Said, oh, you're too old for this. And says, oh, no. So everybody said, no. This is his sheet of ice. He has this sheet. I think it was like 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, like a prime ice time, right? And they wanted to pull it from him. So last question, what's the number one tip that you can share for coaches thinking back when you first started, what would you like to have learned to help them shave 5 years off their learning curve?
Maybe difficult, but I think the mentoring is important. And maybe you can't get a full-blown mentoring when you're starting out, but surround yourself with people who've been around for a while who can show you the ropes. And I remember when I first started coaching, I knew all the textbook information, technical, tactical, mental, but just the day-to-day and men of navigating coaching and how to deal with parents and kids and referees, you can't learn that in a clinic or a book. You need to be around the wise old veteran who can share those nuggets of information. It makes a world of difference.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I was very, very fortunate. I had a mentor coach that I helped coach my daughter's softball team. And he probably forgot about more about hockey and softball than I'll ever know. Like, it was amazing how much. And every time we're in the dugout, tell me about this. Tell me about kind of like Chantel asking, you know, all these other people that she's reaching out to. Because the more you get from someone that's been there, the better off you're going to be as a coach. So, but thanks for doing this. This is great. And like I said, we'll keep the hard stop. And I appreciate actually making the time to do it a second go around. I really apologize for that goofiness on the first go around. We were 3 days trying to debug it. I had to reformat my whole laptop. The bias and everything they were saying. And so what was happening is you were flickering all over the screen and the audio was like all corrupted. I'm like, so the students tried to do what they could and they went, we don't know how to tell you this. And I'm like, okay, and I just came back from Whitehorse. I was in Whitehorse for a coaching clinic, and I was like, what? Gordon Bloom's, it just didn't, I'm like, oh, I didn't even know where to go with it. So, but it was great. I really enjoyed it. So keep up the great work. Sounds like Chantel's got a great career coming down the pipeline and all the stuff she's doing. How many other students have you got with that kind of similar story?
I have one right now. His name's Dave Urquhart. And he's a coaching in the AHL with the San Diego Gulls right now, an assistant coach, men's hockey. I'll just quickly tell you his story. It's kind of neat. So he was on the McGill men's ice hockey team. I think he played about 2006 to 2010, around that. Mm-hmm. And I did some sports psych work with their team. And he would always talk to me, and he was always asking questions about sports psych. And then his last year, he says, you know, can I take your undergrad sports psych class? And he was in management, so it's a pretty difficult program to get into and pretty structured. And I said, I don't think management's going to let you count this as an elective course. And he says, well, I don't care. He says, I want to take your class. I'm going to do all the work. I'm going to work hard. I really am interested in sports psych. So you kind of remember that, right?
Yeah.
Well, he was an undergrad here. He actually just got inducted into the McGill Sports Hall of Fame last year. It's how good. He was a great player. He went to play in the AHL after he finished with the Hartford Whack. And then he went over and played professionally in Italy for 3 or 4 years. And when the McGill assistant coaching job came open, the head coach reached out to him in Italy and said, would you like to come and get this spot? He was playing pro. He was doing a good job. But he says, you know what? I think this is a great opportunity. I want to be a coach. So he came back, and then in his first year, he came to see me and said, you know, I've always been interested in sports psych. Do you think I could do a master's degree? I said, well, it's going to be hard. You're a full-time coach. And, you know, you've got a lot of responsibilities. He says, well, I'll make it work. And so sure enough, we did, and he finished his second year. We had his results done. We're just writing up the final stage of the thesis, and then he gets hired this September by San Diego. And so we're doing it long distance now. So he'll finish in the summer. And his thesis was really interesting. He interviewed top coaches in youth sport in Canada, men's hockey, and youth sport in the United States about how they developed a coaching vision, where did they get it from, and then how did they articulate it and sell it to their program. So Irk, as we call him, is following, I think, a very similar path to Chantel, and it'll be interesting to see where he ends up.
Is that thesis going to be published? Because I'd love to read it.
Yeah, we're just finished. It'll probably take another year and a half.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'll be published. And the coaches that he interviewed are just the top of the top. So it's really interesting to see sort of how they created this vision and got these elite programs and how they maintained it. So yeah, well, it'll be out. And he was very inspired by the work in, you know, in legacy and, some of the other coaches like Sir Alex Ferguson. He's followed a lot of the really great coaches to learn about how they achieve success. So looking something to put on the radar for you.
Wow. Yeah. It sounds like it's going to be a great, when it comes to fruition, the people that he interviewed, were they all like high performance level or was there any grassroots?
No, high performance. We can't give their names, but
yeah, I don't know.
If you search the top hockey coaches, Canada and the U.S., you're bound to see the names of the people that we interviewed with. We can't say who they are.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've got a pretty good idea who some of those guys are. So it's pretty, that'd be great to see when those results come forward, because yeah. Many of them recommended Clark Drake to get in the Hall of Fame. And if it hadn't been for him, a lot of those coaches said, hey, you know, he was kind of our mentor when we were growing up, and even had the opportunity to coach against him, which was kind of painful.
My PhD supervisor had a lot of interactions with Claire Drake. So he had met him and learned from him and shared a lot of that information with me, although I never had a chance to meet him.
Yeah, I would have loved to even, and he's not as quotable as the Pat Summits or the John Woodens of the world. He kind of kept on kind of quiet, but the only coach ever to win two national championships, two different sports, like football and hockey in 1 year. I mean, no one will ever do that again.
That's right.
A whole bunch of other stuff that he did was great. So
that's a good point. Forgot about that one.
Yeah, that one was, well, I mean, it was many years back when specialization wasn't the norm, but still, you got to think about that one. It's pretty big feather in the cap and all the other stuff you did. So anyway, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, and for loveofthegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.